And now, a very special message from Ben Shapiro to the left.
Know that I renounced my membership in the Republican Party. I've given up right-wing sentiments, ultra-nationalist sentiment. I was very stupid, idiotic, thin-skinned, childish, foolish, immature, ignorant, pathetic. I'm really sorry. I now understand that socialism is the solution. Communism looks real nice. Communism is wonderful. I would love nothing better than to join the fun in the radical communist revolution.
We're going
to
kill the rich people. Yeah.
But only if you choose me to be your leader, to bow before, kneel before my feet, and then call me
your daddy.
The thing is, I need to feel special. Like, I'm a big boy. I want to be a big boy because that is what I am.
I am, in fact,
a big boy. And that's true. That is the truth. That's definitely true. My mom says so. So here's the thing. Communist revolution can only be victorious with me as the vanguard, because I have a big boy voice, and obviously the fact that I'm popular and no one has ever heard of you. Basically, I'm the only one who can destroy capitalism, and in return, I expect you to lick my feet. Please, please, please do it. Nobody really cares about Ben Shapiro, and no one has ever loved me, even though I'm popular. I feel so alone. I cry almost every night. Are you willing to accept me as your beloved Lord and Savior? Please, I need the attention. No one's paying attention to me. Pay attention to me! Please! Please! What is your response? I'm waiting to hear it.
This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. This show is a program that covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy for a left that is of itself and for itself. The meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts. So I've got a lot of content for you this week, mostly about strikes. Strike, 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 strike. Boy, you saw it in 80s movies. Don't really see it in pop culture much anymore. So it will come again, though. So I'm going to start with just a general breakdown, or rather a recap of the issues of the last 2 weeks. So first, a little opinion piece from The Observer. Coronavirus drives call for general strike and hashtag not dying for Wall Street. This is by Eric Villas-Boris. So I'm going to go run through a bunch of stories this episode for the next 2 hours about those that are doing wildcat strikes, explain some things, hopefully if time permits, cover workers' councils and worker power and economy run by workers, aka socialism, in that form. And what kind of form that really takes when striking is and worker power is taken to the next level beyond simply the clips that could be seen of workers saying, look, it's not that we're lazy. It's not that we don't want to work 50-hour weeks. It's, we want it. We have a job so we can earn money and earn our keep here in our system. We just don't want to die while doing it. But let's continue. This show is going to be much more about the, you know, direct kind of action and the actions we can take and are taking generally. So first, the call for a general strike, meaning everybody or as many as possible. And we know from now personal experience that you don't really need that much of the economy to shut down to really hurt the ruling class and hurt the people with the boot on our necks or the people that say, pay up, pay up. If the coronavirus or COVID-19 was a full pot of water simmering over weeks of uncertainty and torpid political action, it was an ultimatum to American grandparents that made it boil over. Quote, no one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance for your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? Oh, sorry, that's a question. This was Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on Fox News' Tucker Carlson Tonight. And if that's the exchange, and this is continuing the quote, and if that's the exchange, I'm all in. Meaning sacrifice the old for the economy, a.k.a. stock prices. My message is, let's get back to work, he said, going against recommendations from almost all public health officials, both inside and outside the executive branch. Quoting again, those of us who are 70 plus will take care of ourselves, but don't sacrifice the country. Don't do that. Don't ruin this great American dream. Because you have to be asleep to believe in it. I know, that's practically cliche at this point, right? But that is the politics or our leadership, our so-called leadership, as performance, as a wrestling. You know, they can say and spout out cliches, and no one really has to take them seriously, or that there are a certain percentage that do, you know, like the five-year-olds that believe wrestling is not fake. That it isn't a performance. But, you know, you have heel wrestlers that you love to hate. And even they have their fans because they're just so charismatic. And it's like, oh, well, it's not real. I can cheer for a villain. And then there's the babyface, the good guys, who do the exact same thing that the bad guys do. That they're just, they're more polite. They're nicer to the fans or nicer to the other wrestlers or something. You know, they're bipartisan. Dan Patrick's statement came on the heels of reports yesterday of President Trump's growing impatience and frantic tweeting about the state of the economy. Not lives, just economy. What else is new? Amid of efforts to staunch the spread of the virus. It turns out, however, that Americans are not so willing to condemn their grandparents to die for the sake of a dream. A dream that was never really going to come to fruition anyway. Or it did for one generation, but the rest of the world had to be bombed out in order to get it. You know, referring to the post-war boom. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says grandparents would be willing to die to save the economy for their grandchildren. A tweet from Andrew Lawrence. Hashtag woke up to general strike trending in the U.S. All is not lost, tweeted Naomi Klein, the political analyst and author of The Shock Doctrine, a critique of capitalism and how neoliberal politics affect workers. So to summarize, the shock doctrine is that a net crisis hits, usually a natural disaster, and then the status quo warriors, the establishment, the ruling class, they jump in the gear and use the crisis to grab more power and privilege and wealth for themselves. Every time a crisis has hit in my lifetime, the last 40 years, there has been a spike in inequality, whether it be a recession, the 9/11, or some natural disaster, like, you know, maybe it's more localized, like in Hurricane Katrina. You know, that was when all public schools were basically privatized, all the prisons privatized, everything privatized. This is all of that stuff happens. Like, how did it get this bad? It happened in increments. Every time there was some natural disaster in a locality or the whole country, in the terms of, you know, terrorism, it was power grab for their own benefits. But in their heads, also for the sake of everyone, because what's good for me is good for everyone, or I am doing it for everyone. It just so happens to only actually benefit a few people. Accompanying the general strike, hashtag general strike in Twitter's trending topics list was the hashtag also not dying for Wall Street, which had amassed more than 116,000 tweets as of Tuesday morning. Now, of course, I'm covering this opinion piece first because it's just about the tweets and that it's a popular idea. The rest will be the actual, like, working people doing it, not just talk. The tweets paint a grim picture reflective of the broad discontent at both the government's response to the pandemic as well as outrage at the notion that in the public health crisis, workers should be expected to return to business as usual. Quoting, I'd die for my family. I'd die for my friends. However, if these sons of biatches think that I'm going to die to keep rich assholes rich, they're dead wrong, read one popular tweet. Quote, We need a mass general strike if the grotesque ghouls in our government decide it's good for everyone to go back to work and risk their lives when all of our hospitals are far over capacity and there aren't enough ventilators. Read another. Which is currently the case as we are slowly peaking out here in New York. Maybe. At least as Governor Ghoul Cuomo, because I consider him a ghoul too, because he spent the last 8 years cutting Medicaid and hospital funding and all sorts of things. With the recession, you know, it's, again, recession in New York, cutting the public sector. That's a shock doctrine. Put simply, people are angry. They're angry that they're getting sick. They're angry that it took several weeks for the U.S. to even acknowledge that there was a crisis. They're angry that Trump fired the U.S. pandemic response team that could have taken action when it was clear that we were dealing with. And they're angry that they've been forced to either work from home or lose their job altogether at an alarming rate. One which the Trump administration, you know, you're lucky if you're furloughed. Because if a business can't even survive the quarter, they're just going to fire everybody. That seems to be what's happening. When people are angry en masse, they take action, hence the talk of a general strike in the event that federal and state governments attempt to reopen the economy. So it's conditional on that as long as we have this virus crisis, that it's dangerous to go out and work and to do business as usual. Successful strikes can lead to major wins for labor. Here's an important example, the U.S. Postal Service strike of 1970, the country's first nationwide strike of public employees, was an eight-day wildcat strike, that is, an illegal strike taken without approval of union leadership, or because it also means like to have a legal strike, you have to actually be approved by the National Labor Relations Board, meaning there's a federal agency that actually has to give you permission to strike after you've had a vote and the union leadership is okay, you know, is for it too, which they're usually, as the cliche goes, also corrupt, which they pretty much are. I've interacted with them myself. Or they're just very defeatist, like, it's not worth striking for a living wage, for example. Like, look, you're getting more than minimum, so living wages. But if we wanted living wages, we basically, they just closed the stores. It's not worth them keeping them open at that point. Now, as of now, Trump seems defiant in his wish to restart the economy and lift shelter-in-place restrictions. Now, this was before, I think, he backtracked and now extended it to April. Except I think that's just for federal employees or something like that, agencies and such. Because as far as state-by-state goes, half the country is not following any social distancing orders. You know, because they're still voluntary anyway, but at least, like, the state, the institutions are setting an example. Many are not. The fact that workers are already being hurt, whether they're dying from the pandemic itself or figuring out how to account for lost wages, those calling for a hashtag general strike and not dying for Wall Street have indicated that they prefer the pain of our economy being squeezed to the pain of an all-out control, out-of-control virus killing them or their loved ones. So an adjustment or a realization of people's actual values. The question that remains is how quickly one can or will be organized. And we'll cover some examples of that. First, a kind of longer piece taken from Red Flag, the Australian socialist magazine, I guess. But I'm linking from Hampton Institute, a left-wing think tank. There are not many of them. Here's one. And it's called Everyone's a Socialist in a Crisis. So this is a general overview of the problems of our economy, because I wanted to kind of handle that. Because there's a meme going around, quite popular, about, you know, companies not being able to take a hit. That, you know, they cry poverty, you know, they get, you know, the CEOs, the management class, they're paid more. And the constant excuse of why we can't have workers, living wages, actual protections, is that all of these companies can't afford it, that they're all operating under wire-thin margins. Now, the fact that they all do, in fact, need a bailout as soon as they have a few bad weeks is evidence that there's a grain of truth there. But it was always something to take skeptically, because it's not like management would ever actually share the books with workers, with union reps. Because I worked for a groceries chain with union representation, But it's not like we could still ask for the books and just had to take their word for it when they said, look, we only make a penny of profit for everything sold. And so razor thin margins, as you know, maybe this is just grocery stores. It's probably a lot of other things. Anything retail, anything, you know, like the Black Friday, they're always in the red until the end of the year when there's a massive spending binge that is then based on credit, which then has to be paid back somehow. And so it's usually an indignation that, you know, when people need a bailout, of course, there's never any money. But as soon as businesses, small or large, need it, then they get it. Trillions of dollars suddenly available because money is a farce. As far as it being worth something and something that there's a scarcity of. It's particularly the myth of scarcity. But I see it a different way. I see it as, except for the ruling class, like the bankers, the people in the finance sector, the people who actually make the decisions in the economy, which are the actual capitalists, controllers of the capital. Everyone else is pretty much some kind of debt slave. Renters to their landlords, landlords to the banks, and banks to each other. And if one person can't pay, it all falls apart because it's all one big money cycle. Like water. When the rains don't come, the drought hits and everyone starves in some fashion. So I kind of see it as everyone actually being in the same boat. That everyone is struggling to pay the bills and make the accounts line up. It's just the injustice is that some people, the owners of the businesses, the bankers, the mortgage holders, they make out a little bit better. Their balance sheets include their own incomes. And that's where the injustice comes. But then it becomes a giant pyramid. The only reason they... Okay, let's get into it. One of the most prevalent ideological mantras of Western capitalism is that the market should rule. So this is also a good bashing of market systems here. But as the latest health and economic crisis demonstrate, capitalists soon forget their worship of the market when times get tough. They scream for government money, and plenty of it. It turns out that the market is fine when it comes to whipping workers to accept lower wages, but when it comes to lower profits, the market can go hang. Every student with the misfortune of having studied economics at school or university will know that the market is the god before which we all must kneel. Markets bring consumers and producers together to ensure an equilibrium of supply and demand, the textbooks tell us. We may be all individuals, each pursuing our own private interest, but this selfish endeavor miraculously results in an optimum outcome for all. That's the myth. And I want to mention that, like, you know, it's when you get to the ruling class, what do they actually believe and what really, like, keeps them working, operating the way they do, right? It's not that they're evil or some kind of moral corruptness that doesn't exist elsewhere. It is really that, like, then they have their overlords, which is these abstract ideas, these myths. So it really, like, comes to mind shifting all across the board. But you can't really... The prerequisite for changing one's mind, changing one's headspace, is a change in material conditions. You know, being forced to stay at home for a month, or the loss of one's job. You know, that's what facilitates radicalization in one way or another. And so to get the ruling class to radicalize or change their mind about something, you have to change their conditions. What does that usually entail? You don't even have to step inside a classroom to have received this lesson. It's rammed home in normal times in every newspaper, in every news bulletin, on the TV, in every politician's speech. Just listen to them. Governments can't expand spending on New Start because the markets won't allow it. Governments can't ramp up public housing because that will throw property markets into a spin. Competition should be open between universities because a market in education will sift out the bad providers for the good. The champions of the market, if challenged, to explain how it is that markets consistently result in supplies of goods lurching from shortages to gluts, point to the economic dysfunction of the old Soviet Union as proof that if planning replaces the market, a much bigger disaster ensues. It doesn't take an Einstein, who was a socialist, to see what rubbish this is. The last thing any capitalist wants is free competition, except between their peons, because that might squeeze their profits. Just look at how the supermarkets have destroyed small shops, or how any new industry that emerges is soon dominated by three or four companies globally. Now, I noticed this pattern when I was a teenager, so I'm like, something is not right here, at least as far as the Econ 101, which is practically just primitive accumulation, primitive trading. It's just like, oh, markets are like trading. No, markets are not like trading. But here's another angle to this. Capitalists preach the market for the working class. Stand on your own two feet. Don't rely on the government. But themselves sponge off the public big time. Just look at the billions in subsidies and tax concessions to fossil fuel companies. And this is the annual basis, all right? Huge enterprises, for the most part, extract from the state and federal governments in Australia. Of course, the U.S., of course, bigger than anyone. The vehicle manufacturers rake in hundreds of millions a year from the Australian government for decades until deciding that it wasn't enough and went overseas. This is why big companies and industry groups hire armies of former politicians to lobby on their behalf in the offices of premiers and prime ministers. There's money in government coffers, and they want it. While the capitalists talk about the market setting wages for workers, in reality, they don't really allow the market to do that job. They use the whole apparatus of state repression, the industrial tribunals, the police, the courts, to suppress workers' rights to organize and pursue their demands, you know, in order to actually operate in the market equally. Because a union of, say, thousands of workers can then equal a company with thousands of shareholders. It's the only way they can actually operate equally. When the crisis hits, all the bullshit about the market is thrown into the winds. And that is just what we are seeing now. Faced with the collapse of a capitalist economy for the second time in a dozen years, with massive bankruptcies on the table and the stock market plunging by more than 30%, more to come, fervent advocates of the free market are now embracing government intervention to save their skins. As the Financial Times put it on the 18th last month, world leaders have been forced to tear up the traditional economic playbook, like they had one, in response to the historic jolt in the global economy. Of course, their economic playbook is just shifting money around, consolidating. In the United States, the heart of free market capitalism, capitalists and politicians alike are demanding huge government handouts. You're probably aware of that already. Politicians and advisors just a week ago were scorning the idea of helicopter money. I guess this is in Australia. Government payments to businesses and consumers to stimulate the economy are now trying to outbid each other to push the figure up. The Trump administration proclaiming a state of war in the fight against coronavirus and the economic crisis will shortly launch a huge fiscal stimulus, which is now $2 trillion. In other times, Trump may have denounced his proposals as socialism, but not today. He now boasts his new package will be big and bold. And the great thing about the doublespeak is that, of course, just bailing out corporations, the markets, isn't socialism, right? They can say it's socialism and one, be liars, and then do this and not be liars and when they're bailing things out. Because it's not socialism. So all the memes about like double talk, like yes, it's funny or fun or whatever to point out the hypocrisy of the lying liars and a ruling class. But eventually you have to just like, okay, but you're also being inaccurate. I'm doing a rant here. You know, it's like, look, know what socialism is, which is worker control of the industry. All right. Now, unless the government is nationalizing it and then putting the unions in charge of the management of, say, the firms, then it's not socialism. So let's move on. Now for the long cavalcade of stories about striking and the strike wave. Now, there are times in the past decade where I would see kind of coverage of strikes. And it kind of like there was a little inkling in my mind, like, is this a strike wave? Does this count five places at once, you know, or something like that? Or the teacher's strikes? Those weren't strike waves. They're events, and it's a building momentum of comfort with doing, with striking, with saying no, the power of no. So this is published by Citizen Truth. Don't know where they're out of. You know, in the independent news sector, if you call it that. Guest post, So anonymous. But the strike wave is in full swing. Amazon, Whole Foods workers walk off job to protest unjust and unsafe labor practices. One of the best ways to thank essential workers is to support the fight to improve their lives. Written by Julia Connolly of Common Dreams. Labor rights advocates on Monday urged the public to show support and solidarity with Amazon employees who walked off the job at a Staten Island warehouse following what the workers said was an unacceptable response by the company to at least one case of the coronavirus. Update, there's now four. For confirmed ones, I think the company was only admitting there were two. Between 50 and 200 employees at the warehouse known as JFK 8 walked off the job around 12:30 p.m., so that's midday, days after at least one case of coronavirus was reported at the facility. Christian Smalls, an employee who is organizing the strike, told CNN the number of employees who have tested positive for the coronavirus officially known as COVID-19 is actually between 5 and 7, though the company has only acknowledged one. So the numbers keep changing. The workers are demanding that Amazon shut the warehouse down and ensure it is sanitized before requiring employees to work again. We're not asking for much, Small said. We're asking the building to be closed and sanitized and for us to be paid during that process. By ignoring the threat of transmission to other workers, tweeted the grassroots group New York Communities for Change, Amazon is putting profits over safety. So again, a community organization, nonprofit kind of thing, is helping, providing input and consultation to workers on how to do this right. Amazon is allowing contract workers to apply for sick pay if they test positive for the coronavirus or need to self-quarantine due to exposure. So these are the concessions that were won by workers during the Spanish flu epidemic 100 or so years ago. Just to those who actually get sick can get paid. Everyone else has to keep going and then basically be exposed. But the company is not providing them with paid sick leave as a matter of policy. Employees who are able to get tested are required to report for work while they wait for their results, a process which can take days, and thus could be exposing the warehouse's 5,000 workers and anyone they interact with outside of work to it. Amazon facilities are quickly becoming a breeding ground for this pandemic, Small said. As of Monday, the virus has infected more than 144,000 people in the U.S. Of course, that number has gone up. And most of any country in the world, including more than 60 grand in New York State itself. We know we're not alone at JFK 8, and that conditions are similar in Amazon facilities everywhere. Philip Bruce, a warehouse employee, told New York Communities for Change, Amazon's actions do not match their statements that they are prioritizing our health or the health of the public. JFK 8 strike comes days after workers at the Amazon facility in Queens refused to work their night shift after a fellow employee tested positive. The action has coincided with a strike Monday by gig workers for the grocery delivery app Instacart, more on that later. Advocates on social media urged consumers to support the Instacart and Amazon workers. Solidarity, not charity. The richest man in the world can't even provide basic protection for his workers during this pandemic crisis because it hurts his bottom line, tweeted New York Assemblyman Ron Kim. I stand in solidarity with Amazon workers. Kudos to him. Vice on Monday reported that employees of Whole Foods, which is owned by Amazon, plan to call in sick Tuesday. Everyone calls in sick at once. It's a type of strike because, you know, some worker contracts, like say the one I had, allowed me to call in sick. And I didn't have to provide a doctor's note if it was just one day or one shift. But if everyone did that, the store would grind to a halt. You know, they would not be enough staff there. Those would come in. If it was organized, you actually ask everyone, call in sick on this day. And then management are basically left to do everything themselves. Depending on what kind of manager you have, you may wish this hardship upon them. Good managers are the ones that kind of work with the staff in the trenches. Whole Foods has kept stores in a number of cities open even after reports that employees in the stores have tested positive. The supermarket chain is offering paid sick leave only to workers who test positive. Again, they have to wait before they get a positive test result. And it's a policy which, as with Amazon, could expose many workers and shoppers to the virus itself. Quoting, my doctor asked me to quarantine for 2 weeks and I haven't been able to get paid time off, one anonymous worker told Vice. Whole Foods said we wouldn't get it unless we got a positive test. There are a lot of people in my situation who aren't receiving time off. It's hard to imagine that those who couldn't afford to do so would stay home. Whole Foods says that if you're feeling better, you should come in to work. Ignoring asymptomatically, or if they're minor symptoms, so like you can still stand on your feet. Because trust me, I've been around tons of people coming to work sick. I've come into work sick. Because, again, like many others, I really couldn't afford. Like, my paycheck was small enough as it was. I could not go to every possible shift. Now, there were short shifts, so I knew that if I could just hold out for the time that my Dayquil lasted, I could make it. But meanwhile, I'm exposing, you know, I'm touching a lot of things, even if I'm washing my hands more. Now for more on that Instacart strike, looking at gig workers. Now, this is an interesting case. I need to actually look into this myself because as someone who did home shopping in my previous job, now I'm actually a little interested in doing this if it was just like once a week. But it seems that they actually hire their gig workers. So like they're going from gig to gig, customer to customer, but they're hired as someone in the employ of the company. So they're kind of like both a gig worker and a contractor, which I guess is most of the app workers. So I'm actually still a little uneducated, I guess, on this. Because when I was a home shopper for a grocery store, it was like I'm doing the job for as long as there were orders, which is why my paycheck would sometimes be less than nominal. Like, so I'd be assigned a number of hours, but maybe there would only be enough orders to fill half a shift. But at least I was scheduled for this many shifts. With Instacart, I'm guessing there are so many orders that you can get, and that would add up to maybe 3 or so hours of working, and you get paid for the by the hour or by the order. And then maybe it actually adds up to minimum wage. Maybe. Instacart's gig workers are planning a massive nationwide strike. This is reported written by Motherboard, part of ICE. Amid the coronavirus pandemic, the grocery delivery company has refused to offer its, get the number, 175,000 workers basic protections like hazard pay, hand sanitizer, and paid leave for those with pre-existing health conditions. This is written by Lauren Corey Gurley. Okay, Instacart shoppers are planning a nationwide mass revolt over the grocery delivery app's response to the pandemic. On Monday, workers say that they will refuse to accept orders. So that's one way of striking, just not working. So this is like more of a sit-down strike, since there's no actual place to go. There's not like one place that these workers are meeting. There's nowhere they can be locked out. I think that's almost like the advantage over past worker struggles, is that before there was a factory or a workplace, the management could lock you out or hire more security to keep you from actually going in and messing things up or picketing properly. As I, there was a strike, and the sheriff's department was basically paid a lot of overtime to basically police the perimeter and keep the picket from A, being effective, so business could keep going with scab workers or bust-in workers or from the jail. They want an additional $5 an order. Oh, goody, goody. Free safety gear, which would be more value than $5. Expand its paid sick leave to include workers with pre-existing conditions. Now, see, as gig workers, I'm unclear about paid sick leave being like applying here, because the point of the gig work is that you basically do it when you are able to. And if you're not able to, you're not doing it. So it's interesting for gig workers to actually tell the company, like, you're making hella cash here. Distribute it to those that are not, like, who are regular gig shoppers. And, you know, putting in equivalent to 40-hour weeks and give us payments when we can't, when we're not doing orders. That's interesting. Workers say the strike will last until Instacart agrees to these terms. Let's say paid sick leave to include workers with pre-existing conditions who have been advised by their doctors not to work at this time. So not only those that are tested positive, but those that if they were to catch it, they would be in the top percentile that would die or it would be very dangerous. The March 30th walkout would build on a wave of wildcat strikes sweeping across the country. In recent days, Amazon warehouse workers in Queens, New York, sanitation workers in Pittsburgh, poultry plant workers at Purdue Farms in Georgia have all walked off the job, demanding greater protections from coronavirus and leading to calls for a general strike or mass strike action across the country. Meanwhile, the upcoming Instacart strike will mark the first time gig workers in the U.S. who face the double bind of working on the front lines of the virus and lacking basic labor protections, like health care, have walked off the job in response to it. The health and safety of our entire community, shoppers, customers, and employees, is our first priority, a spokesperson for Instacart told Motherboard. Our goal is to offer a safe and flexible earnings opportunity to shoppers, while also proactively taking the appropriate precautionary measures to operate safely. We want to underscore that we absolutely respect the rights of shoppers to provide us feedback and voice their concerns. Notice that they talk about the workers, they use the word shoppers instead, right? Now, shopping is the action they're doing, but Jesus Christ. But it's like working is consuming. Like you're still it's the treatment that is, it's the disturbing language and trend that isn't like that overt, but it's like it slips in, like in these little from the PR side of a company, that treat having work as a privilege in itself, which is a Victorian Dixonian concept, which of course has existed for quite a long time. It's actually been in our heads. It's the thing you got to kill in your head that like I have a job and I should feel lucky that I get to work, that I get to work for my bread. It's the moral thing. I could be those degenerates not working 50 hours a week, not working 40 hours a week, killing myself in the process, whether quickly or slowly. But it's happening faster now. So it's, you know, when things happen fast, people can actually pay attention and react in a more intelligent way than when it's a slow burn. Continuing with the PR fluff. It's a valuable way for us to continuously make improvements to the shopper experience, and we're committed to supporting this important community during this critical time. Because it's interesting, like, so the people getting the service, the receiving the service, are they the, do they mention who they are? Okay, they refer to them as customers. And the shoppers are the workers. It's so interesting. But horrifying. In a blog post Friday morning, Instacart announced several new features and offerings to address COVID-19, which address none of the gig workers' demands. Isn't that just nice? While Instacart's corporate employees are working from home, Instacart's gig workers, so there's a divide between those that are in the company's offices. So their health needs have been addressed. Maybe they're getting paid sick time, which they probably weren't getting before, but the gig workers get nothing, are working on the front lines in the capacity of first responders. Vanessa Bain, a lead organizer for the upcoming Instacart walkout, and an Instacart gig worker in Menlo Park, California, told Motherboard, Instacart's corporate employees are provided with health insurance, life insurance, and paid time off, and are also eligible for sick pay and paid family leave. By contrast, it's gig workers who are putting their lives on the line to maintain daily operations are afforded none of these protections. Without us, Instacart will grind to a halt. We deserve and demand better. Now, interviewing about being a union worker, unionized at a grocery chain, was that I also got a life insurance policy and the ability to pay health insurance that I couldn't afford. So it only really would have mattered if I was a full-timer and plan to work there for 10 to 20 years or something like that. I was there as a part-timer and there as a kind of almost a respite worker. And I wasn't making enough wages to stay there. And I certainly, because it's assumed I would basically, it would be one out of three jobs that I had, but I'm not doing that. I refuse. To date, Instacart, like its Silicon Valley peers at Uber, Lyft, Postmates, and DoorDash, have offered up 2 weeks of paid sick leave to gig workers only if they test positive. So everyone else can just be at risk. At a time when tests are in short supply, though, that is a hollow concession. Because here in my area, we don't have enough tests for everyone to get tested. Now, I think those supplies were coming in, like there's a mass testing site that's going to be set up at our university. But that did not exist in the last 2 weeks. That's why, you know, shuttering the whole economy was kind of like the only action to take until supplies were available. For others around the increased risk for contracting the virus, it means going without pay. Oh, yeah, and the offer for covering up to 2 weeks only lasts till April 8th. For many gig workers who live paycheck to paycheck, this means there's no other option but to work while sick. Quote, "This job lifted me out of poverty, and I was able to help my daughter with tuition for college and pay my mortgage." So it does seem rather lucrative by this quote. "But I just discovered I have a problem with my heart and stopped working during this pandemic because I decided it's not worth me ending up in the ICU. An Instacart gig worker in Chicago with congestive heart failure who wished to remain anonymous because she feared retaliation. She is currently living off her savings and hopes to make it through several months without income from Instacart." This could mean that she has another job that is maybe more isolating. And the Instacart was basically working on the weekend. Unions won the weekend just so that, you know, that's the thing about working three jobs. It basically means you're working on the weekend, you're working in evenings. You basically don't have free time. To have a savings, actually, like, send a kid to college, you need three jobs or two jobs. Two good jobs. Now they're calling us household heroes, and Instacart is fully operational across North America, but they're saying that we need to test positive to get 2 weeks' salary. It's a hollow process. It's all optics. They're putting our lives at risk. Last week, Instacart announced they will hire an additional 300,000 gig workers in the next 3 months, more than doubling its current workforce. And this got me thinking, maybe I should be looking into it. As demand for home-delivered groceries increases with customers looking to reduce trips to the grocery store. Now, I wonder if you're an Instacart worker, you're doing the shopping and you're doing the delivery. So that means you also have to be driving, you need a working car. It's a lot of, God, imagine the costs. Yeah. And then, like, you're buying it and then you're reimbursed. What if that, like, there's a lot of points where it could fail and you're basically left holding a lot of costs, because that's what these companies, they're so profitable because they put all the costs on the workers, and that's why their margins are a little healthier. Last few weeks have been the busiest in Instacart's history. Can't imagine why. Our teams are working around the clock to reliably and safely serve all members of our community. Now, add that to the fact that the grocery stores are running out of things, and that supply is very hit or miss. How do you complete orders when half the store is destocked? Instacart has been busy crafting a rather heroic public image as the saviors of families sheltered in place, and as the economic saviors of laid-off workers, announcing Monday its plan to hire that 300 grand new workers. This is quoting Bain, the organizer again. In truth, Instacart is providing no protection to its existing gig workers and profiting significantly off of this pandemic, like war profiteers. Instacart did not immediately respond to the request for comment from these allegations, but they did respond with the other, you know, hokey statement. I think I'll wrap up the hour by updating about the Amazon worker strike so that Mr. Smalls, he has been fired. So that's that company retaliation that is so feared when you stick your head up. But the point is, you have many leaders. Workers, when organized, are a legion. To have a leaderful movement. And it also means that it's a cause, another cause. There are many instances where someone organizing gets fired, and the people they were actually organizing then do a walkout, do a strike, and get them their job back. And then the company reverses their decision, because a firing is not final. Nothing is really static or set in stone. No matter how much the managers like to impose the the feeling, and I feel it all the time when I was working for a corporation, that there was nothing you could do. You know, when they make a decision, you can't overturn it. Not alone, but then I would, let's say there would be the, of course, let's go with the union, and then we can overturn their decision. But then the union wouldn't fight to overturn the decision. They would either sign with the company saying that the decision was justifiable. It's in the text. It's in the contract. They're allowed to make these decisions. Or if there was an injustice, they would go like, it's not worth striking over this. We wouldn't. Or even if we did strike, we would lose. And so there were defeats. And it's like, well, what was the point of having a union then? We would have to do a wildcat strike, you know, an illegal one, anyway. And that's the case with the teacher strikes, that those are all illegal strikes, not approved by the union. Because the union, as far as the leadership, okay, not that it exists, the fact that you're unionized meant that they could communicate easily and that they were already in a kind of solidaric group. That's my interpretation. So does that not sound like a wave to you? But here's from It's Going Down, that wonderful radical publication. Workers launch wave of wildcat strikes as Trump pushes for a return to work amidst exploding coronavirus. So this is going to be a long cavalcade of examples. Let's go through it. So I'm going to reiterate, it's actually repeating that first Observer article I read. With millions of people now wondering how they are going to make ends meet and pay rent, let alone survive the current epidemic, a new wave of struggles is breaking out across the social terrain. Prisoners, detention center detainees are launching hunger strikes as those on the outside demand that they be released. Tenants are currently pushing for rent strikes starting on April 1st. The houseless are taking over vacant homes in L.A. Covered that last time. And workers have launched a series of wildcat strikers. Sick outs. That's what it's called, sick outs, and job actions in response to being forced onto the front lines of the pandemic like lambs to the slaughter. Tweeting, all cats are beautiful, or Vicky. Capitalism has always involved a how many deaths are acceptable calculus, and the answer has almost always been the number of deaths at which people start rising up, minus one. But as tensions flare and economists predict upwards of 30% unemployment in the coming months, there is also a growing push from within the elites to herd us all back to work. Trump has stated that he wants things back to normal by Easter, which is now completely reversed. Old news. A move which threatens to undo anything that has been achieved by social distancing and attempts at quarantine. More and more, the refrain from within the Trump camp, Fox News, and sections of MAGA aligned right, as Republicans and Democrats near a deal for a corporate bailout. Of course, again, old news. They have reached a deal. It is absolutely horrible. Even the paltry checks that are only going to be sent out to the newly unemployed, right? So if you needed help and are struggling and are still affected somehow, but not completely unemployed, you get nothing. Still means testing. As the ship is sinking, we still have to means test. And that was both parties doing that. And the progressives, so-called, voted for it. Something showrunner Jimmy Dore, sort of pseudo-fan, you know, he's constantly pointing out when he's covering these stories that, you know, Bernie Sanders is saying he's for the workers, he's in solidarity, but he's not calling for a strike. He's not supporting the strikes. He's not supporting worker action. The action to take is to vote harder, to campaign harder, minus the switching his campaign to funding charity work for the around the virus. I think that money should go to strike funds, if it were me. If I was a senator running for president for 8 years or 6 years. Trump kind of going back, killing grandma to trigger the libs. Like a true heel wrestler. But in the face of this anger, this mounting anger, on social media over the past few days, calls for both rent strikes and general strikes have gone viral. Here we go. As the economy crashes and U.S. society demands more and more on the continued operation of dwindling supply chains, workers and service sector jobs that remain open, such as grocery stores, not only finding themselves working at a crucial node in the economy, but with a new sense of potential power. So I'll return to that thought on the other side of the break. This has been Three Left Show, and be well. We're the podcast that was 8 years late, but won the Sign War of 2017. Welcome back to the Three Left Show. This is your left-wing radical reading hours. Covering the strike wave, labor power, and general how that can lead to or represent a restructuring of the economy for the better. Leaving off where we were with the paragraph from the It's Going Down coverage of the strike wave. As the economy crashes and the U.S. society depends more and more on the continued operation of dwindling supply chains, workers and service sector jobs that remain open, the so-called essential workers, the R essential workers, such as grocery stores, not only find themselves working at a crucial node in the economy, but with a new sense of potential power. This means speaking that workers, simply, that workers at different points in the supply chains can have a huge impact on the economy and thus gain leverage simply by engaging in direct action or refusing to work. So the lack of action, in a way, is a taking of action. This reminds me of the historical example. It's, you know, generalizing. But after the Black Death, where in much of the world, a quarter of the population died, there were a lot less peasants to do the work, and suddenly their labor was a lot more valuable. And so there's kind of an argument that the Renaissance, the Reformation, the rebirth of European Western civilization, or at least the evolution of it, was triggered by the, you know, natural causes of disease, that it was such an impact, such a crisis, that there needed to be a shift in consciousness, or there was, that resulted as workers started thinking more about their own interests instead of a collective one. So for better or for worse. So as Bloomberg wrote, Bloomberg, the press agency that he owns. These pockets of resistance along the supply chain underscore the balancing act needed to contain the coronavirus and protect workers deemed essential while delivering goods and services. It's an especially acute issue given that transportation, labor, and other logistical woes have already made it hard to get food where it needs to be in the pandemic era. Calling it an era. While none of the meat plant incidents so far caused operational disruptions, there are concerns that more may be coming, causing supply chain hiccups, right as consumers are binge buying groceries to fuel shelter-in-place lockdowns. The U.S. pork industry has requested more guest worker visas, and there's speculation that plants have been running full tilt not only to supply unprecedented retail food demand, but also to get as much production in as possible before virus-related disruptions slow the pace. And worker-led disruptions are part of that calculus. We're barely mentioning in the mainstream press or on cable news. Already there is a growing wave of wildcat strikes, self-organized labor actions, sick outs, and work stoppages. Much of it centered around the refusal to work in environments where workers may be exposed. If Trump is serious about forcing millions of other people back to work by Easter or mid-April, or now there's a case post-April, ensuring the death of potentially millions at the hands of coronavirus, then calls for a general strike and potentially even broader action will only continue to gain steam and popularity. Now, actually, I dropped the word revolutionary action there. I think I'll post-insert it. Because it's not just a refusal to work, but then a call that the government that says that the shareholders' value, the stock prices, are worth more than our lives, is a government that is, in fact, illegitimate. No matter how many stupid elections and how good the show and the political circus is, we're not going to take it seriously anymore. We want a new one. Not a new circus, of course, with new performers, but elect new people, vote the bums out. No, we want them all to resign now with new elections that are fair, that are funded, that are on paper ballots. So now it's going to go through a cavalcade, as I put it, of the rolling strike wave in auto workers. Let's start with them. Work stoppages and wildcat strikes have broken out at several auto industry facilities as workers demand an end to the spread of coronavirus in their workplaces. This began back on March 12th when, quoting, workers at the Fiat Chrysler Windsor assembly plant downed tools on May 12th. Over concerns about the spread of the virus at their plant and learning that a worker at the FCA Coromo transition plant in U.S. was diagnosed with COVID-19. This was followed up by workers in Fiat Chrysler Sterling Heights and Jefferson North assembly plants in the Metro Detroit area took matters into their own hands last night and this morning and forced a shutdown of production to halt the spread of the virus. The work stoppages began at Sterling Heights last night, only hours after the United Auto Workers and the Detroit automakers reached a rotten deal to keep plants open and operating during the global pandemic. Meaning, union leaders and the corporate managers working together. And the rest of the workers, the actual rank and file, say, no thank you. The same day, scores of workers at the Lear seating plant in Hammond, Indiana refused to work, forcing the shutdown of the parts factory and the nearby Chicago assembly plant. March 18th, workers at Schaap's First Shift followed suit, staging a sit-in and refused to touch vehicles rolling down the line once their shift began. This is called a sit-down strike, where you show up to work, so you're not technically breaking any rules, but then you don't do any of the work. Because hundreds of people handle the vehicles in rapid succession on the assembly line, they are a major potential source of transmission for the virus. Management again sent workers home and canceled the second shift today. This is awe-inspiring, one worker stated, referring to the workers' action to force the closure of the plant. Workers at Dundee Energy Plant in Ann Arbor and Toledo North Assembly followed suit with their own job action shortly after. Shifts at the Warren Truck Assembly and Ford's Michigan Assembly have also been sent home. A Facebook Live video from Toledo showed dozens of furious workers crowded around Local 12 Vice President Brian Sims, demanding that the plant be shut down, who then repeats through the back door yelling at workers to calm down. And what you don't tell someone who's already angry to calm down. That is de-escalation 101. You do not tell someone to calm down. There's a host of other things you can say, but not calm down. And it was usually a joke. It's when you say someone calm down when they're in a mood or a state, it's a lack of empathy, it's a lack of human compassion, it's an actual problem, right? The problem is not with the person who's upset. It's the person who says calm down
is literally coming from a place of condescension. That's why that's a problem. The UAW, that's automotive workers, should be actually fighting for us to get, the union should be fighting for us to get off of work. The union and the company care more about making trucks than about everybody's health. I feel like they aren't going to do anything unless we take action. We have to got to band together. They can't fire us all. You're here. Need more strike wave examples? Agricultural workers. In Georgia, several dozen Purdue workers at the poultry plant are about, of about 600, walked off the job on May 23rd over growing anger at low pay and concerns surrounding the spread of coronavirus. So it's very unfortunately, but several dozen can refer to hundreds, or at least 100. Because then like several dozen refers to like, we didn't do a count, but it was like 200 or so, maybe. In media interviews, those involved with the Wildcat strike explained how the company sees them as expendable, according to one report. Approximately 50 employees at the Purdue farm plant, so several dozen also could mean 50. the numbers are always not precise. They walked out March 23rd, saying they didn't feel safe in the plant because of the coronavirus, says WAMZ in Georgia. Workers say they don't feel safe working around others who could be potentially exposed. They add that they feel Purdue isn't doing enough to keep employees safe and isn't sanitizing the workspaces. Back to Amazon. Last month, we fought Amazon to win our legally entitled sick leave. Tonight, we shut down our warehouse to protect each other and our communities from coronavirus and Amazon's greed. From Amazonians United, which is the pre-union organization. How about bar workers? Workers at Crush Bar in Portland took action, launching a sit-in after being laid off in the wake of the pandemic. Not just like furloughed, laid off. But this is quoting them. We did it. 48 hours after staging our sit-in, management provided us with our accrued sick time checks. Meaning like they had accrued sick time and the management wasn't, they fired them without providing it. They basically stole their freaking money. Thank you for the community support that helped us draw attention to this injustice. We couldn't have done it without you. With that said, we the workers are still waiting to hear back on our second and third demands. Half pay for canceled sick hours and the guarantee that every laid off employee will be rehired upon the bars reopen. So meaning, treat us as furloughed workers, not just expendable at-will employment. You're fired, you're rehired, maybe. PDX Eater, this would be like the Portland area coverage of restaurants, I guess. Last night, all 27 of Crush's employees were laid off in preparation for today's forced closure of all dine-in food and drink businesses. At around 3:30 p.m. today, 12 employees arrived at the bar and then refused to leave, protesting owner John Clark's decision to lay off all employees without any financial aid, with the claim that he has broken the law by denying their use of accrued sick hours to cover lost wages. The protest, which was set to last 24 hours, was dispersed by Portland police after an hour. Yay for the cops! Protectors of property rights, first and foremost. Not enough bus drivers. Let's cover the bus drivers. On March 17th, bus drivers in Detroit launched a wildcat strike in response to dirty buses and lack of access to areas where drivers can wash their hands. One report wrote, Detroit has shut down the city's public bus system because a vast majority of drivers refuse to work over concerns. The city is negotiating with the Detroit Department of Transportation drivers to alleviate their concerns in hopes of restoring bus service Wednesday. Due to the driver shortage, there will be no bus service today, quoting the city. We are asking passengers to seek other forms of transport while we work to address our drivers' concerns. Too bad they couldn't have done that beforehand, right? Drivers have been expressing concerns that they aren't adequately protected from the coronavirus. Among the concerns, the buses aren't cleaned frequently enough, and drivers have been unable to wash their hands because of the statewide shutdown. The Wildcat strikes also resulted in free fares for riders. The drivers' union backed them up and their brief work stoppage, less than 24 hours when all the demands, fares will not be collected for the duration of the crisis. Excellent job. So there was a union that did what it's supposed to, and thus it was over faster, They got all their demands. Beautiful. In Birmingham, Alabama, bus drivers on March 23rd also protested and went on a wildcat strike, refusing to work scheduled routes due to their concerns. So that's ongoing. Or at least they went on strike for a day. Call center employees. Call center workers and members of the IWW in Portland, Oregon, which is where they're very active, launched a one-day strike on March 4th, leading to workers receiving paid leave in the face of the pandemic. IWW student workers in Lewis and Clark College just want a major list of demands. And this is because it's going down. They cover IWW stuff all the time. So when they're collecting their, you know, data for this story, they're going to cover IWW stuff. The decentralized, more militant union, which usually represents smaller workplaces. So here's one of them. Call center employees. IWW student workers at Lewis and Clark College. So I guess they get credits or what are they and some pay for doing the call center for the college. Just won a major list of demands after the college closed for the semester. So the college was closed, but not the call center. Nice. In Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on March 18th, other members of the IWW engaged in a sick out strike to demand better pay and working conditions, especially in the face of the crisis, which has brought with it increased workload. Another victory. A week ago, the CalPTEL Workers Union held a sick in at Madison, Milwaukee. So that's the details, the name of that. They just found out that they won one of their demands of 90% adherence. You feel that? Watch your step, because the world is getting a little bit more wobbly. The IWW is, they're called the Wobblies. Don't ask me why. There's a lot of different ideas on why. Union reported on social media, days after a sick out, an expression of collective discontent and a protest of our working conditions, CalTel admin had announced that we will be given 15 extra minutes of auxiliary time per shift, so actual breaks. For an 8-hour shift, that means 91% adherence is needed to avoid discipline. So they did this just so they got a 15-minute break, or an extra 15-minute break in an 8-hour shift. Whoa. Let's keep pushing forward for $15 an hour. Our other demands in workplace democracy. Let's remember that this break from the normal austerity that governs our workdays can be ended by the whim of admin at any time. The boss's promises are just words. A union contract is set in stone. So there's the other side of it where, like, you know, businesses are always on the hair of profitability, that 2 weeks of bad business or no business and all falls apart. But at the same time, at least when things are going well, that profitability is then available to be shared. City maintenance. On March 20th, several dozen city workers walked off the job in Cleveland, Ohio. Up to 35 Cuyahoga County sewer maintenance employees walked off the job and called in sick Friday morning, citing their safety concerns. Sanitary engineers, virus safety concerns. The sanitary engineers who maintain regional sewer systems did not want to continue working because they were concerned about going into people's homes and being in close proximity. So these are particular workers who actually go into people's homes and are thus exposed 10 times, hundreds of times more than others. And this is a particular set of workers in a particular set of circumstances. These things matter. Let's look at wildcat strikes in construction. In Las Vegas, construction workers are pushing for a wildcat strike, according to one report. And by report, meaning like local reporting. Thank God there's still some of it around. Construction workers at the LA Convention Center site said that they are considering working off the job this week. At the moment, they're just considering it, but they're talking. This week, because they don't feel their health is being taken seriously. Things are getting scary at work, one said. A large group of us are ready to walk off the job. Construction workers on site at the LA Convention Center expansion say conditions were unsanitary before this was an issue. They say that it hasn't gotten any better. As far as trying to prevent the spread, they're telling us to wash our hands and act social distancing, but as far as actually protecting us, they haven't done much, said one worker. Basically handing over the guidelines of social distancing is basically saying, it's up to you. It's on you. Electricians working on a long-term renovation project at the Kaiser Hospital in Sacramento decided to walk off the job due to unsafe working conditions. Here's an interview of one of them. What happened yesterday was a result of a lot of talking amongst the rank and file over the preceding couple of days. Everyone is aware of the severity of the outbreak and the risk it poses to our health, to the health of our loved ones. We saw a lot of abrupt changes around the hospital, for example, bringing in large tents to set up testing sites. And we would be walking down a corridor to get materials for our job site a few feet from where they were being set up. And at least a couple of our guys were going through a different part of the hospital and saw a patient being escorted wearing gowns and masks. And they would yell at our guy and get out of the hallway. So I showed up in the parking lot in the morning, and there was already a large meeting of union electricians, kind of a spontaneous thing. And at least one of the other crews was going to do the same thing that day. We all agreed to get our stuff and go. How about fast food workers? And it goes on and on and on. Fast food, garbage collectors in Pittsburgh, that was mentioned before. Port workers in Oakland, they're very well organized, very militant there. And that's where it ends. So there we go. Lots and lots of small, but strike wave. And it's nice to kind of have them all in one place and to know that this isn't just in one area. It's not just where it's the worst in New York City area, that where workers talk to each other and actually have solidarity. They can do massive things. They can do something, not just lie down and take it. It's great. It's great. Okay, one last coverage of a strike, but this time it's the rent strike. So let's talk about the logistics. It's kind of vague talking about the rent strike that it would start this month. How would it be organized? I think there's a site to kind of check that out, so I'll need to link that. But let's go to more localized, that a rent strike is something to be done place by, like a workplace, place by place, building by building, or when you are a tenant of a larger landlord, all right? Not your petite, you know, a few properties or a retired person who's supplementing their income kind of thing. That is different than when the landlord is some big corporation, right? So just as striking at a big corporation and not your mom and pop hardware store, if they still exist, which again, free markets, right? freely compete to freely fail. Rent freeze not possible while state ban remains intact. City says as Chicagoans prepare for rent strike amid coronavirus pandemic. This is filed by Ariel Chung of the Chicago Tribune. So main actual newspaper here. Wednesday, April 1st is a looming deadline for many who have found themselves out of work due to the pandemic. Rent will be due for thousands of Chicagoans, the first major test of their finances since Governor Pritzker issued a statewide stay-at-home order that left many unable to work and others forced to choose between making a living and avoiding exposed by staying home. And isn't it interesting, the contradiction that making a living may entail a risk of dying? One of the many contradictions in stark relief. Theodore Burt, 23, lost both his jobs at a bar and at the University of Chicago performance venue because of the outbreak, so like a stagehand. Now, without any source of income, he and his partner are struggling to afford their Hyde Park apartment. It was beyond stressful, Burt said. We were just operating at a level where panic wasn't even an option anymore. Chicagoans like Burt are joining a growing call for rent strike, both locally and nationwide, from Andersonville to Beverly, from Hyde Park to Harvard Park. These are all neighborhoods in Chicago, I assume. Residents are working together to pressure retail companies and landlords into forging rent changes or evictions, foregoing them, until things return to normal. They posted signs, shared the rent strike hashtag, and displayed white sheets from the windows in a show of solidarity. Others, including landlords with portfolios big and small, prefer more balanced measures in the hopes of weathering the crisis. And while politicians are searching for a solution, smart guys they are, they acknowledge it could take time to work its way through the clogged bureaucratic channels. As of Friday night, an online petition had gathered more than 12,000 signatures calling on Mayor Lightfoot to issue an indefinite freeze on rent, mortgages, and utility payments. All three are in fact needed. It also asked for a Cook County Circuit Court to ban new filings for eviction or foreclosure. On Friday, and then it becomes then a fight of when do we define when the crisis is over? Now, if this is truly, and this is my concern, that this is like a 9/11 event that, quote unquote, changes everything and allows the state even more intrusive powers. It allows employers more control over workers and, you know, where they are, where they're going. It's bad. And something to fight. And they'll define when the crisis is over. Now, the fight this month was the crisis is not over until the end of April. At least. Right? Again, it's almost to the benefit of workers. So then it becomes a question, of course, my mind's not made up. Is it a benefit to extend the crisis as long as possible? Because the longer, you could say that the war on terror was like an extension of the 9/11 crisis taken to today. Like it's still not over, or until Obama declared that the war on terror was over, and now we're just going to do all the police actions and not call it the war on terror, even though it's the same thing, if not worse. I mean, you still have to take your shoes off at the airport, right? On Friday, Lightfoot announced a city grant program that will give $1,000 payments to 2,000 Chicagoans. That's not a lot. Who have lost their jobs or otherwise been impacted by the economic fallout. Now, of course, still better than nothing, but like not a lot. The state's ban on rent regulations means Lightfoot doesn't have the authority to enact a rent freeze. Joyce, said Don Terry, spokesperson for the Chicago Department of Housing. While Prisker expressed support for repealing the state's 97 Rent Control Preemption Act, during his gubernatorial campaign, the ban remains intact. Isn't that nice when politicians say that they express support for something in a campaign and then don't actually act on it? Maybe by the end of his term. His office did not immediately respond to a request for comment on that. Mayor's office has directed residents to the city's coronavirus-driven housing resources. Oh, yeah, that's going to cover it all. But the city's grants and counties... current eviction memorandum, which allows landlords to file court paperwork for eviction but paused court proceedings, they aren't enough, said an organizer with the Autonomous Tenants Union. I've covered them in the past. The group that launched the online petition, because they organize rent strikes against really bad landlords. You know, the slum lords. Now it's everyone. Not just the people who are in the roach-infested, you know, moldy apartments that can be, you know, that need to be organized. Now it's everyone actually does need to be involved, like to actually say, oh, this does affect me now. That's the thing I like about this crisis, is that it's not just one state. It's not just New Orleans hit by a hurricane, or New York with Long Island hit by a hurricane, or New Jersey. It's the Jersey coast. It's everywhere. It's everyone. Is affected. Everyone has to think about how they're going to react to this. Now, of course, you have the quote-unquote red states reacting very poorly to it. Very poorly. It's business as usual the whole way through. Totally diluted. Of course, it's not the whole state. Those that are, in fact, not have brain worms, that's been called, they're stuck in there. And they're in a really dangerous position. Freezing mortgages and utility payments is also vital because that gives landlords the financial bandwidth to forgive missed payments. If they decide to, of course. But you make a requirement that they forgive. Even, you know, as if missing a payment because you can't work is a crime that has to be forgiven. That's the language. It's baked in that the worker is like, you're already guilty. You're already a prisoner. You're already a slave, to use that harsh language, but really. It doesn't do anything to not take care of landlords, because then it's just the banks that evict the tenants instead. So there's a problem with, you know, the half measure of we're going to stop evictions or evictions in courts. But, you know, once the crisis is over, then everyone will then be evicted, because then they'll owe back rent. And that's the problem. Like, the rent strike's demand is actually to ensure that, in fact, yes, the economy actually has shut down, that payments will not be made for the duration. Now, of course, that will, in fact, crash the economy worse than even a full depression would. But we need the people in power to admit that. They need to freaking admit that, in fact, they require us to work. The hours and the conditions and the and the bullcrap jobs, the ones that aren't doing any, that don't have any social value, that are quote unquote non-essential, that even when they're not done, who notices? Because there are many examples in my life right now where I'm checking in with, say, like people who manage my checks or whatever. They say we're doing our best to actually maintain our production and efficiency because, unsaid, we're actually pretty essential. And you're doing something that's essential. My work, the work I do, is an essential service. It's needed by people. It's the job. It's why, like, I'm not unemployed right now. I'm actually pretty happy about my situation. It's a very privileged one. It's one that involved a lot of decisions on my part to say no to certain careers and jobs, because I knew that the next time there's some crisis, that I would be sacrificed. And then, so it wasn't worth it. It wouldn't be worth the few good years I would have with a good salary or something. It wasn't worth it to me to know that, like, I'd be thrown out and lose it. And then anything I built up, let's say I was earning, like, for the last 5 years, let's say I was earning a good salary at an architecture firm. You know, I would have the security to get a mortgage and have a house. But with this crisis, I'd be fired. And where would I be? I would be completely smashed. My life would be in ruins. At least, you know, but at least it's consistent. I'd rather have that consistency than the highs and the lows. The memorandum we're calling for, yes, it is an extraordinary policy intervention, said the organizer, and this is an extraordinary moment. But as COVID-19's impact worsens, the government is straining to solve a flood of problems, making it difficult to get every issue addressed in a timely manner. We're trying to elevate these concerns to the governor's team, Guzzardi said. I feel housing hasn't risen quite to the forefront of their response because they have so many other aspects to focus on, like the healthcare side. But for many, time is almost up. So at the moment, the rent strike is in a petition stage of gathering people who support the basically a rent strike that is imposed by the state, basically a state, what you call it, policy, to not evict people, to not charge rent. So one last kind of a walk-off, but then to transition into the final topic of this episode. Also from Motherboard. Vice is pretty good at covering worker strikes. Go figure. But it makes sense. They're kind of the punk. They bill themselves as a punk brand. General Electric workers walk off the job. This time it's General Electric workers. They demand to make ventilators. All right? So it's not really for their safety concerns this time. But they're walking off and doing a wildcat strike because they want to switch what the factory's making. Let's check it out. GE workers who normally make jet engines say their facilities are sitting idle while the country faces a dire ventilator shortage, right? To the point where at the moment here in New York, Governor Cuomo, the ghoul he is, he's taking ventilators from hospitals upstate to transfer them downstate. We're still in the climbing stage with our numbers here upstate. We're going to need those. But obviously with the state of things in New York City metro area, they do need the ventilators now, right? But it's because, like, there's such a scarcity of them. Why is there such a scarcity of healthcare equipment? Why don't you ask the free marketers, huh? This is filed by Edward Oswego Jr. On Monday, General Electric factory workers walked off the job and demanded that the company convert its jet engine factories to make ventilators. Workers protested at GE's Lynn, Massachusetts aviation facility and held a silent protest, standing 6 feet apart. Union members at the company's Boston headquarters also marched 6 feet apart, calling on the company to use its factories to help the country close its ventilator shortage. These protests come just after General Electric announced it would be laying off 10% of its domestic aviation workforce, firing nearly, how many? 2,600 workers, along with a temporary layoff of 50% of its maintenance workers, in a bid to save the company $500 million to $1 billion. This news came as Congress stood ready to pass a multi-trillion dollar corporate bailout that would include at least $50 billion in federal assistance $25 billion in loans and temporary tax relief. So it's still not enough. Still not enough. And this is where, like, the unemployment spike isn't just furloughed workers, right? It's not only the bar workers, too, that might be rehired or be hired somewhere else. These are baked-in layoffs. These are, like, permanent. Amazing. Regardless of the bailout, regardless, it didn't matter. They didn't need those workers. They didn't need that profitability or whatever production of the jet engines. It's all superfluous. In a press conference, members of the Industrial Division of Communication Workers, that's the IUECWA, explained how General Electric's current layoffs, so this is the union that they're in, how GE's current layoffs and closures would undermine future efforts to increase ventilator production. Without experienced workers to operate now empty and idle factories, production will likely be slowed down. The local president, Jake Agarwaga, offered his plant, located in Arkansas City, Kansas, as an example of how much manufacturing capacity could be converted. More than 52% of his workforce has been laid off, and several football fields worth of factory space is currently sitting idle. Quoting him, "If GE trusts us to build, maintain, and test engines, which go on a variety of aircraft where millions of lives are at stake, why wouldn't they trust us to build ventilators?" GE's healthcare division is already one of the country's largest manufacturers of ventilators. So union members believe that other factories could be converted to produce the life-saving devices. Hospitals around the country say that there is a critical shortage of them, and many experts have implored the president to invoke the DPA, the Defense Production Act, as mentioned before, and around, to require companies to produce them, as you may have heard of it, even in the nightly news broadcast. Trump finally decided to make GE produce ventilators over the weekend, the first of a series of deals, because they're going to be paid very handsomely for that, that may eventually call on GE to increase the supply. Ventilators are desperately needed at hospitals in New York, California, so on, big states. They soon will be in short supply from the East Coast to the West Coast, from Puerto Rico to Hawaii. Puerto Rico is lacking a lot of things. But this is also quoting the local union president. "Most Americans are not aware that the best ventilators are already made by GE within the healthcare company's healthcare division. Our country depends on these highly skilled workers." So that also means, like, they already have the patents and the documents and the plans and the tech and so on. The people to train others to make them. "Our country depends on these highly skilled workers, and now they're wondering why they're facing layoffs instead of having the opportunity to use their unbelievable skills to help save lives." GE did not immediately respond to the quest for comment. Which is no way of saying we're waiting to see what happens until we make a move. I think in the rent strike article, I guess I skipped it or something, but points to mention there are that in the meantime, while they're waiting for the government to do something, which again, the bureaucratic red tape, it's going to take months before a proper response from the state is made. The landlords, these are the rental companies, big ones, where it's like hundreds of tenants, thousands of units. They want to negotiate with people one-on-one, which means it's like you still pay rent, but maybe we'll work out a kind of payment plan for you so that you owe me rent even after you move out or I evict you later or something of that nature. Or you pay me more rent. And that's the problem with the bailout package. It's like a lot of money for loans to small businesses, but it's like, well, they are losing income. Like the income is gone. It's not like they're gonna get more sales later to pay back the loan. But that's how loans in capitalism work. Like it's the loan and interest, so you have to create more value. How do you create more value? You have to squeeze it from somewhere. You have to get it somewhere, right? Usually it's idealistically in the form of getting more customers over time. But how do you get more customers over time, especially if you're in an industry or selling a product where there is a ceiling, especially when that ceiling is like, well, in order to sell this many of the product, there actually have to be more customers with disposable income. But if that doesn't increase, then you can't increase the value. That means you can't pay back your loan, and it all falls apart anyway. We're going to have a recession, whether or not there was a pandemic. So in the last 10 minutes of the show, I want to talk quickly. There's kind of about, let's tie the worker strikes and the logic that I've been running through towards what the ultimate intelligent response would be. I'm going to use intelligent response instead of the word solution, because solution implies that the problems that we're dealing with are completely solved and we never have to think about them again. But that's never really the case about anything. So what would an intelligent response to, like, the big demand? Of course, to have a planned economy, because capitalism has and continues to fail. Even if it doesn't fail stockholders and, say, the nation as a whole, which is usually the counter, it doesn't succeed for everyone. It implores, or rather, there must be a class of failures. It was understanding that where I just, like, I can't support the system anymore. What can we have instead? So, circling back to the beginning of the episode, which I always love to do, let's bash the free market. The free market offers no solutions to the problems we face. To overcome the present crisis, we have to take the reins in our own hands and democratically plan a future for all. This is filed by Tyler Zimmer from a site called The Rampart Magazine. In the midst of the 2008 economic meltdown, Marxist geographer David Harvey, like his lectures, remarked that there is currently masses of productive capacity lying unused, side by side with masses of unemployed labor. In a world that is full of unmet human needs, how stupid is that? In the context of the pandemic, and once again, a global economic order on the precipice of meltdown, we might reformulate Harvey's point as follows. There are right now massive hordes of technology, resources, medicine, and buildings lying unused, side by side with masses of untapped human talent in a world full of sick and vulnerable people in desperate need of care. To say that this state of affairs is stupid is a vast understatement, and it is cruel as it is irrational. It doesn't take any training in economics to see that as a society, the appropriate goal we should be seeking is a unified fashion, in a unified fashion, meaning unionized, striking, is saving as many lives as possible. In fact, aiming at any other goal, whether they be bailing out big banks, propping up corporate profits, insulating investors from losses, doing the bidding of big drug companies, insurance, in a context like this seems fundamentally wrong. It's inhuman. It also doesn't take any training in economics to see that the most efficient means of realizing this goal is not being taken advantage of in the slightest. Let's be clear. This is the richest society in the history of the planet, with huge stores of resources, know-how. There is a name for the obvious solution, democratic economic planning. Now you're probably thinking I might say socialism. They are synonyms. Michael Moore did this at the end of his one of his movies, Capitalism, A Love Story, where it's like I thought he was going to say socialism, like we need something different than capitalism. And he said, democracy. Well, yeah. To be specific, the industrial capacity of the U.S. is immense, and right now there are, and have been, for more than a month, massive shortages of key goods, whether it be ventilators, masks, testing kits. The response to the masks. Obviously, that's been the major mainstream news point, that we all need to be making our own masks because we don't have industry here in America, or we can't actually order companies to do it, which the president is slowly, but it's just like, should have been done a month ago. Competent. Hell world. Profit-driven free market has utterly and spectacularly failed to address these shortages. If we had a democratic economic plan to deal with the crisis, we could immediately begin retrofitting manufacturing facilities to begin producing massive quantities. So at the moment, we're not planning anything. It's piecemeal. It's like ventilators deals are being made, mask deals are being made, a la carte, right? It's like ordering a meal a la carte. It's inefficient. You use more plates. And it's usually more expensive in the long run. Oh, it most certainly is. Have you ever ordered a la carte? It's like tapas or little small plates. If you ordered your steak, not being very vegan, but let's say you order your rice dish, your vegetable, your dessert, all separately, at a restaurant, the cost is going to be more than if it's a fixed price dinner. And that would be literal. By democratically planning the economy, or planning the economy in any way, you fix prices. And this is all such tragedy. But if it's planned, and you plan in, and this is something that the Soviet Union didn't do well, which we obviously would improve on, is that we plan to include luxuries, to include diversity, to include art and science. Well, they had science planned in, but to include art and a lot of it, and include diversity. You plan for diversity in the economy by allowing firms to apply and put into the plan. Like, oh, I want to participate as an artist. Okay, how many artists in this community are there? Can we meet their needs as well as the needs of everyone else with the manufacturing capacity? Of course we can. We just have to plan it. So let's finish this first. The U.S. has an estimated 900,000 hospital beds and a population of more than 327 million. When we talk about flattening the curve, the assumption is that the curve must stay below a predetermined line that is defined by the current capacity of our healthcare system. But what about raising that line? What about massively expanding the capacity of our system? Now, of course, this is the scarcity versus abundance mindset. Planning the economy means we could actually have abundance, that we wouldn't have a scarcity. Unplanned, a la carte, we deal with scarcity. Local governments that say, we can't afford that. We can't do that. And that not only goes for governments, of course. It's through the businesses. And then it trickles down to the families. Everyone is in the same boat of thinking in terms of scarcity. If we planned together, collectively, and that also means democratically, we could have abundance. We wouldn't have to talk about who is getting ventilators and who isn't. GE factories, or a firm's factories, worker-controlled and managed, the workers would decide, okay, instead of making jet engines this month, we're going to make ventilators. It would be their decision, and they could make it not only in response, so we could still be kind of like a market, in response to needs that would then be formulated by the collective will, by an institution. So what I'm explaining right now is called Pericom, which is a model of economics. So look up Pericom, P-A-R-E-com, for the full explanation of that. You can also contact me directly if you'd like to time trade, and I can give you the full lecture. But otherwise, just to give you the boilerplate version there, to show that it's not crazy talk, and it is not the same as the bureaucratic planning that did not include the free exchange of information of the Soviet Union. Big problem with there is that there was not free exchange of information. There were many penalties for doing that, or penalties in doing that. There were weaknesses. Weaknesses that have been studied, and it does not be the same. In a global crisis like this one we're facing, democratic planning becomes a question of survival. Going back to raising the line of capacity. This is a key point that is hardly ever part of a conversation and is striking. It shows how weak, irrational, and inefficient our market-based, profit-based system is in the face of a humanitarian crisis. The basic idea of socialism and democratic planning is, I would call, in the toolbox of socialism. Socialism is like a toolbox. There's a lot of different tools in there. Tools for different tasks and problems, right? It's not a blanket one thing, you do it all like at once and it fixes everything, whatever. It's utopian, it's fanciful. But it's a toolbox, and there are different tools. Democratic planning is one of them. And so the basic idea of socialism is that the economy should be under the democratic control of the people who make it run, the essential workers. The basic idea of capitalism is that the economy is controlled by a small class of owners who perform little or no productive labor. So not even the managers and the CEOs. I mean, they're kind of in there, but it's really the stockholders and the management, the wealth funds. They're the capitalists. But last paragraph. To deal with this crisis, the population, means all of us, needs to have the keys to the economy, the control. Right now, under capitalism, the capitalist class has the keys. But there's no one at the steering wheel. They are too weak, too risk-averse, too greedy to even come together as one to save even themselves. We're heading towards a cliff, and all they care about is their own individual bottom line. They are individually buckling down and hoarding their wealth in the vain hope that it will save themselves as everyone else perishes. To survive, we need to take the keys away from them. We need to take the wheel into our own hands and steer the economy in a direction that it obviously needs to go, towards saving as many lives as we can and meeting the human needs of all as efficiently as we can. That is socialism in a nutshell. A democratically planned economy that prioritizes human need instead of corporate greed. The time to fight for it is now. So thank you. Now I enter the last minute of the show. My profound thanks for listening. Important skill, as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send me. Ideas for the show, stories, or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe work like mine is worth paying a living wage. So you can by supporting the show via its Patreon page. Support can also come with your time by telling others you believe would be interested about the show, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages, all of which is found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps, and a full archive of the shows and show notes and info about myself are found at threelefts.news. Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas, thinking, and projects talked about here in practice yourself. Thanks. Until next time, stay safe and wave the flags of the Three Lefts.